My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am speaking with Michael C. Zussman. Michael, welcome to All Classical, and thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We're doing this interview early in the morning, so it's really thank you again. This is a cookbook and a history book, in a way. It's the title of the book is The Artisan Jewish Deli at Home, and published again by who?
Anders McNeil.
Anders McNeil. And I grew up in New York, and this is comfort food of the most Hamish type. You know, it's the kind of, it's the thing that people say, kasha and varnishkis, and it just makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck because it brings up so many memories. It's like the Madeleine dipped in tea for people who grew up with this kind of food. But somewhere along the way, somewhere around the 70s, I began to realize that if you eat corned beef sandwiches and pastrami and a potato, fried potato pierogi and stuff like that your whole life, you're going to die at about the age of 45. So as many of us did, unfortunately. My doctor used to call Jewish food a slow pogrom. Yeah, I know. So is the purpose of this book to adapt the comfort food that we knew growing up into a more modern milieu? Is that a fair statement?
I think that is a fair statement. We've tried to take the modern take that we're seeing at these artisan Jewish delis across the country, adding a little Portland twist to it, but keeping some of the traditional dishes too. You can't ignore a kishka. You can't ignore knishes or any of those great dishes that start with the letter K.
Yes, that's right. Kreplach, for example. Yeah,
those two.
Yeah. And in case you're not among the initiated, these are all foods. Kreplach is like a dumpling. It's a wonton is the closest analog that most people say, but it's just a dumpling. Kasha is buckwheat. It's a groat made from buckwheat. And when I was growing up, Wolf's had the monopoly on it. It was a brown box with tiny little kasha in it, but what I get now is the whole grain kasha, which is a nice, bigger, fluffier kasha than we used to get when I was a kid.
You probably get better quality stuff now than you could 20 years ago. I think that's one of the things that we've seen is, you know, we saw the industrialization of food generally in the United States, including the deli, and now places around the country, and I think our book too, are trying to emphasize higher quality stuff, do it yourself, make it at home, use quality ingredients, and make it great.
Yeah, and if you're not initiated into this food, if you don't know anything about it, this is a good place to start because it's more in keeping with what you may know, foods in your kitchen that you would know, rather than the strange-sounding, you know, titles that we're giving it here. For example, one of the things you do in this book, which I thought was very cool, was to have seasonal variations on recipes, foods you can get during the year that would change how you create the dishes. Yes,
that's a very Portlandy, I think, twist on the deli, and I give all the credit in the world to Nick. He's just a recipe machine. But you know, here in the Willamette Valley in Portland, we're so lucky, we're so attuned to the seasons, and it just made perfect sense to make seasonal borscht, seasonal brisket, which I didn't know there was such a thing, seasonal chicken salad. It's all there, and I just think it's a great addition to the book.
Your co-author is Nick Zukin, who is also half of Kenny and Zook's, one of our local delis, and I think it's one of the better ones, but I'm constrained from saying that because in the interest of full disclosure, Kenny and Zooks is one of our underwriters. So I think, yeah, right. I mean, it means something.
Who knew?
As a nonprofit, we have to be careful with stuff like that. Kenny and Zooks makes their own corned beef and makes their own pastrami. And their pastrami is not what I would call a traditional pastrami, but it totally knocked me out the first time I tried it. And I think it's the best pastrami in town by far.
Well, it's heavy on the smoke, which I think some people liken more to Montreal smoked meat than to traditional pastrami. But the point is it gets all the loving care that you'd possibly want in a cured meat product. I think it's wonderful, too. A little sweet, a lot smoky. To me, it makes the perfect Reuben sandwich.
Yeah, now there are several things about this book that I found interesting. One is you have interviews with experts and restaurant owners. They're short interviews, but they're illuminating in their way. And the other thing is you mentioned traditions of like New York and Montreal. And if you lived in Philadelphia, if you lived in Seattle, if you lived in Los Angeles or lived in New York, everything was slightly different. The delicatessen culture was not a clone from city to city. For example, I just had a Montreal bagel for the first time this year, and I said, oh, these are smaller and sweeter than the bagels that I grew up with. So every place has its own little quirks, I guess, about this thing. But you clearly were cognizant of that when you did the book.
Sure. We were tuned in to different things going on around North America. But, you know, much of it's, if not the same, similar. There are slight variations. To me, smoked meat and pastrami are kissing cousins. I would suspect that all but those in the know, the mishpucha out there, would probably might not be able to tell the difference.
Footnote, that means family. Yes.
It does mean family. Yeah. And I love when you use Hamish because that means homey. And,
yes,
and that's really defines deli food in a lot of ways, too. And dovetails perfectly with what we're doing because, you know, mostly you get it in restaurants now that are called delicatessens, but the tradition arose from people making these dishes at home.
Yeah, I think that's right. I read something interesting here that I did not know is that pastrami started out as chicken and
duck
until it came over to this country. And can you just talk a little bit about that? That's quite a story.
Sure. The root of the word pastrami is basturma, and basturma was essentially a dry cured, frequently duck, and it was of course dry cured so that people could carry it around with them, and so it would last a long time, which is a theme in Jewish cooking because the Jews tended to move from place to place sometimes. Sometimes not because they wanted to, but because they had to.
You ever hear that story about why someone asked Isaac Stern why so many Jews play the fiddle? And he said it's easier to carry than a piano if you have to leave in a hurry.
That makes perfect sense.
Yes.
But in any event, basturma eventually was adapted. And of course, when Jews came to America in the late 19th century, beef became more abundant. And then the need for a dry cure wasn't as important. And so that became adapted as well.
And, oh, I just have to, I tell this people this every time, pastrami is Romanian, not Italian. So people think that pastrami is an Italian.
Just because it ends with an I
doesn't mean it's Italian. Exactly right. When I grew up in New York, we had our local deli. And to me, that was the best deli in the world because it's what I knew. As I got a little older and I began to increase my area of foraging, I began to find the classic Lower East Side delis. I didn't grow up on the Lower East Side. Isaac Gellis, Schmokel Bernstein's, Katz's, which is probably the most famous deli in the world based on When Harry Met Sally because of the famous fake orgasm scene in Katz's with one of the great lines. I'm not going to go through the whole thing.
It's in the book,
it's
actually.
In the book. Yeah, that's right. And I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and everybody's having hysterics about the scene. And all I'm saying is, oh, my God, they're in Katz's. I can't believe it. So, you know, you take out of these things what you can. When you were a kid, where did you go to a deli? Where was your local deli?
To the extent we really had one in Portland, it would have been Rose's.
I remember that place.
The owner was a fellow by the name of Max Birnbach. He died a few years ago in his late 90s. His son was my best friend. We used to go skip the line, get in, eat for free. The two of us would order the entire Noshers platter, eat about half of it, and consider ourselves very lucky. I would not say for a New Yorker, Rose's would be considered a traditional deli, but it's as close as we had in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. To a traditional deli in Portland.
Well, in New York, the thing that happened was the kosher-style deli. There used to be delis were kosher, period. You couldn't get dairy products there, and all the meats were kosher. And then suddenly, as things began to change, not suddenly, gradually, as things began to change, people moved to the burbs. They wanted to have maybe a shrimp salad sandwich. They wanted to have maybe a Reuben, which has got cheese and meat together. Things began to change. And then, you know, ham sandwich. You could actually get a ham sandwich at a kosher style deli. So,
well, yes. You know, the Reuben sandwich would be a heresy to a kosher Orthodox Jew. I mean, it's
trafe.
It mixes cheese and meat. Yeah. Yet it's considered a deli classic today.
Yeah.
The tradition probably began to break down almost as soon as it began.
Now, Kenny and Zooks started out as a pop-up deli on Hawthorne. I used to go there on Saturday from time to time, and it was at a fairly limited menu. And did you discover Kenny and Zooks there, or what was your relationship to the place?
They discovered me, I think. I was making bagels a little bit back in 10 years ago. And I had a little bit of a cult following. I was on the board of the Portland Farmers Market, and they would indulge me and let me sell bagels once in a while. And I think Nick and Ken found my bagels and thought they were pretty good. And I know they were simultaneously thinking they had talked to each other. And so the root of Kenny and Zooks bloomed there, and I supplied them with bagels back then and maybe some challah, which I'm a bread baker by hobby. So yeah.
There's a place for you in heaven for that. I have to tell you that.
Thank you.
Yeah, if for people not living in Portland who are listening to this, when I moved here, it was impossible to get a good bagel here. Impossible, at least to me. I couldn't find any place that did it. And then a place opened called Kettleman's, and the day they opened, they were the best bagels in town. You didn't like them. We can talk about this in a second, but eventually, they were bought out by a group that I won't even mention because their bagels are so inferior that I can barely stand it. But years ago, I used to argue with people that 5,000 years of Jewish culture and tradition had been reduced to the bagel. And then there was the Lender's Bagel, which rendered it so inedible to me, in any case, that I just felt like, you know, all was lost. So what's the good theory of a good bagel, and what was your problem with Kettleman's? I find that interesting.
And Kettleman's loved the fact and touted the fact that they boiled their bagels. But boiling your bagels is simply what distinguishes bagels from rolls with holes. The other elements that I think go into making an excellent bagel are ingredients. I think you need to use a little bit of sourdough starter, which I do. You need to use a little bit of barley malt syrup. Time is your biggest ally. The bagels, once they're formed, need to sit in a refrigerator. They need to retard, in baker's terms, for 24 to 48 hours, then a quick boil, then a bake at high heat so they're good and dark golden and crunchy on the outside. That's what makes a perfect bagel, in my estimation. Now, everybody associates a perfect bagel with what they grew up with and loved. Kettleman's, I think, tended to underbake. I don't think they used all the same ingredients. But it's all a matter of taste. I mean, I'm not going to take away from anybody's love for Kettleman's, because many people did. They became the de facto standard because they were available widely, whereas Kenny and Zook's bagels, at least at the time, had limited distribution. And I, of course, rarely made them and never made them in quantities so that they had a broad audience.
Are they using your recipe at Kenny and Zook's for their bagels?
As far as I know, they definitely started with it, and I think they are. Their bagels, I think, are still excellent.
Oh, yeah. Old South Portland. This is interesting to me. When I moved here, Old South Portland was gone. What is it? John's Landing, I believe, is where Old South, or is that too far south?
How about I-405?
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. This is an interstate spur that was built like a dagger through the heart of Portland. And one of the things it did was scrape old neighborhoods off the face of the earth so that you could put in this ferocious highway. And Old South Portland, that used to be the Jewish section of town, yes?
Jewish and Italian. It's where my dad grew up. It's where his parents lived. In fact, there's still a few areas that you can find the old houses. Near Portland State, some of the old streets, if you can find them. The Lair Hill neighborhood still exists and still has some vestiges of Old South Portland.
It also has a tram covering it, so.
Things change. The 405, I wrote about it in a little essay that's in the book because I thought culture was important. And back in the 1960s, there was little thought to cultural displacement during a period of urban, what was called urban renewal.
Yeah, boy, there's a loaded term, eh? I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Michael C. Zussman. He, with Nick Zukin, is the author of The Artisan Jewish Deli at Home, telling you how you can make foods that you may have grown up with or not. You know, if you're curious about this, if you want to know why Jews have heartburn all the time, then you can look at this book and say, oh, yeah, this food's really good. I could stand a little heartburn with this stuff. This book is out now. Where can you get this? Pretty much anywhere? Or
Powell's has it. I know it's available online.
At Amazon?
But yeah, I'm a big local guy, so I would always recommend people go to Powell's.
Okay. One of the things that made me laugh out loud here was French toast made from babka. I thought that was hilarious. Babka is, there's a group of baked goods which can't decide whether they're bread or cake. Babka is one of those things. And you have a chocolate babka recipe, and then you have, before you have the chocolate babka recipe, you have a babka French toast recipe in the book. And I thought that was hilarious because that's really gilding the lily. It's taking a delicious sweet cake and making it even delicious, more delicious and sweeter.
The story is that that recipe comes from our good friends at Wise Sons Deli in San Francisco, Evan and Leo. Evan and Leo are young guys. They wanted to rediscover their own tradition and began this little deli in the Mission District in San Francisco. This is a dish that they put on their menu, and as they tell me, they had to take it off the menu because people told them it was too rich.
No kidding. That's hard to believe. I mean, well, no, maybe it may not be hard to believe now, but 50 years ago, you would put sugar on it too. So.
I made the babka actually 2 weeks ago because it's not my recipe. I hadn't actually made it before, but I of course it starts with a batch of challah, which is my recipe, and I found that it was quite a good dish, and I could see where making French toast out of it might be a bit much for some people. Not me. I would order it in a second.
Mm-hmm. I noticed the West Coast variations on things, one of them being gefilte fish. Now, I've actually made gefilte fish in my life, something I will never do again a second time, but it's hard work, and we had a lot of fish, and it just took days to make it. So gefilte fish is actually stewed fish. Gefilte means stuffed, but it's basically fish that's ground up, spiced, put in little balls, and then kind of boiled to
poached. Sure.
Poached, yeah. Now, back east, we used whitefish and carp, two cheap but tasty fishes. You have a recipe here for a gefilte fish that has salmon and halibut, which I thought perfect, you know, perfect for the West Coast.
Well, now, of course, all seafood's expensive. Salmon's expensive. Halibut's expensive. But back in the 60s and before, salmon and halibut were cheap and abundant in the West Coast. There are stories of people walking across streams on the water because the salmon were so thick in the water. So the dish naturally evolved here, cheap and abundant being the theme. So whereas hake and pike and carp were cheap back east, salmon and halibut were cheap here. So that's how that dish evolved. It's a natural evolution based on what was around and what didn't cost too much.
Yeah, coming from the East Coast, I tell people the only time in my life I've ever had enough fresh salmon is here. It's part of the culture, really, so it doesn't surprise me that it's, besides lox, I mean, lox is nothing but salmon, but, oh yeah, there's another thing. Let's talk a little bit about lox. There's a recipe for lox in here. You call it gravlax because it's made of the same system that gravlax is made, but it lacks some of the spices that real Norwegian or Swedish, whatever it is, gravlax has. This is just plain belly lox like we used to get in the stores, yes?
I would have to defer to Nick on that that particular recipe. I'm quite certain that it's a simplified version, but I that's one that I do not actually know the answer.
Yeah, I'm sorry that Nick isn't here to elucidate, but I make lox also. Whenever I can get a nice piece of salmon, I'll make lox out of it, and it's a very, very simple recipe. There's no smoking involved at all. It's basically cured in a kind of a brine in the refrigerator. It takes about 5 days to make it. And the recipe here, the book is worth getting just for having that recipe, because if you can make lox at home, you will do it. It's easy, and it's better than the stuff you get in the stores.
Think of the money that you'll save.
Think of the money that you'll save. That's right. And it doesn't take any time. That's the whole thing. It's very, very simple.
A lot of these dishes, when you go and buy them, they're expensive because of the processes involved, if not the ingredients. That, I think, is one of the goals we have with the book, is look, you can buy a brisket and turn it into pastrami that otherwise you'd pay a lot in a store for. You can buy salmon and avoid buying lox for five times the cost.
Yeah, I know. When I go into a store now, I look at lox and my eyeballs roll back in my head. I mean, in New York, we used to have what was called belly lox, and then there was Nova Scotia. Belly lox was what I really liked. It was saltier. It was came from a slightly different part of the fish. It wasn't, and it was cheaper. So, of course, in my family, we had to go with cheaper. But that's the thing I grew up loving. And, you know, I eat Nova Scotia now, and it's all right, but I still long for the old days. We can get a quarter of a pound of belly lox sliced thin. So this book talks about artisanal delis, and you mentioned this place in San Francisco in the Mission District.
Wise Sense.
Yeah. Is there a movement for this kind of thing across the country?
Yes. It's not a huge movement, but there are examples of artisan delis that have popped up. I'm certain there are more that have popped up. In fact, there were two that opened after we finished writing the book that I gave credit to because I knew they were there, and I've actually tried one of them and not made it yet to the other. But it's a small movement, but it's consistent with the idea of small batch, locally focused, high quality, which is what, you know, we struggle with whether to use the word artisan, because it's taken on some negative connotations. It's been co-opted in some ways. But there's no other way to express though that group of descriptors better than, I think, artisan. But there's a wonderful place in Brooklyn. There's a wonderful place near Miami that's called Josh's. There's a wonderful place in Washington, D.C. called DGS.
Really?
Fantastic. It's right in DuPont. I was fortunate enough to visit there. I'm going to go visit there and do an event with them, in fact, in October to promote the book and promote their business, which I think they're doing wonderful things there as well.
Yeah, I lived in D.C. for 18 years before I moved here, so when we go back, I will definitely hunt this place down. I'll tell them you sent me.
I would urge you to go try it. Wonderful food.
Now, one of the things I was reminded of in this book is that analogous to African-Americans in the South, Jews in Europe are usually poor and had to use whatever they could get. So they ate organ meats, things like that. And sometimes these things put people off. Sweetbreads, I mean, sweetbreads cost a fortune now, but they used to get thrown away. And so we learned to cook them and to eat them. The thing is, a tongue sandwich. To me, a tongue sandwich is one of the great joys of life. When you tell people it's beef tongue, they just go, ew, but it's really delicious, isn't it?
It has a wonderful texture. The texture of tongue is silky. It doesn't have a strong mineral flavor that many people associate with organ meat. It's not just Jews either that enjoy tongue.
The Mexicans, yeah.
The lengua. Yes. I think the key to serving any organ meat in a restaurant is to call it a name not in English. It makes it a little bit less scary. When you call it lengua, it sounds almost romantic.
So you call it lotion in Yiddish.
Any word other than what it actually is probably will help sell it for those aspiring restaurateurs out there.
The other thing is the neglected, unduly neglected bialy. Everybody knows about bagels. You can get bagels in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I found when we were in Bisbee, Arizona, which is right on the Mexican border, they had fresh bagels. There was a great bagel bakery in Bisbee, Arizona. My eyeballs roll back in my head at the thought of this thing. But bialys, nobody knows what a bialy is. Tell people about bialys.
Bialy is essentially, if you can think of a pizza shape, and then think of it about 5 inches around, topped solely with onions, a little bit of poppy seed, and a little bit of salt. That's your classic bialy. I've been making them for years. It just seemed like something I wanted to make, and there are none that are widely available in Portland.
Yeah, the name comes from Bialystok in Poland, and allegedly that's where these things started. But it does not have a hole in the middle like a bagel does, although it has a slight depression in the middle, which is where the onions and all, you know, the other things go. But the texture is totally different from a bagel. It's, for want of a better analogy, it's more like an English muffin than a bagel is. It's in that spectrum, I would guess.
It's a completely different texture. I think one of the reasons they've never achieved the popularity of bagels is they have a shelf life of about 2 hours.
Yeah, right. And I know for eating smoked fish from what we used to call appetizing stores, we could get things called sable and smoked whitefish and smoked sturgeon and things like that. A bialy is better for those than a bagel is, at least in my estimation.
It works. It works well with smoked fish. It works equally well just by throwing a pat of butter on a hot one and throwing it in the toaster for a minute. See, whatever you enjoy the most.
Eventually, there's something I used to call integration by digestion, where, you know, you have somebody over for a meal and you sit there for the whole meal and talk about the stuff you grew up eating. And this is one of the ways that people get to know each other. And I think it's impossible to dislike somebody if you love their food. So invite somebody over and, you know, feed them and talk about what you ate as kids.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Are you going to do another cookbook, or was this a labor of love culminating in one product?
For me, it'll be a one and only. I'm not as big a recipe guy as Nick. I would assume Nick will probably write another cookbook because he's much more recipe focused, and I would expect that we would see something else from Nick coming down the road.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a stupid question. Am I going to ask it anyway? If you knew you were going to have your last meal on Earth, what would it be?
A Reuben sandwich.
Seriously? Okay.
I love a good Reuben sandwich. Okay. I'm just a sucker for that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, mine would be something similar. It would probably be pastrami or corned beef and knishes and, kishka. Start out with some kishka. I'm building a whole meal here.
And I would, of course, have to add, because it's in the book, a square of my grandmother's kegel.
Oh, yes. Now, you say kegel and I say kugel. It's a tomato-tomato kind of a thing, right?
It's a regional variation. It's a dialect variation on the same thing, a noodle casserole, essentially. In the case of my grandmother's, it's a savory version that has every dairy ingredient known to mankind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mother made two also. She made a savory and a sweet kugel, and the sweet kugel was always dessert, but the savory kugel as a side dish, make your brains fall out. It was one of my favorite things to eat.
We still have them at every family event. My daughter, who's about to be 16, demands it, and my brother's kids all demand it as well. I love it. It's you make enough, one casserole is enough for about 15 people. There's always leftovers.
Yeah, my mother was a pretty good ethnic cook, and my favorite thing that she made was pot roast. And you put the gravy over kasha and varnishkas. Varnishkas, by the way, it's a farfalle. It's a noodle, a bow tie shaped noodle, an egg noodle. And I realized that she knew nothing about cooking with wine and things like that. So when I make my kasha and varnishkas, I use now chicken instead of the beef. And I use wine and I use mushrooms and I use ingredients that my mother never heard of. And it still tastes like my mother's pot roast, only a little different. And of course, it's not, you know, it's a little healthier.
It makes perfect sense. I mean, let's face it, deli food is a fusion cuisine. It was a cuisine of the different regions of Eastern and Central Europe that came together in New York City and the Lower East Side. It only makes sense, and it's true of cuisine generally, that it evolves. And so what you're talking about is just a natural progression that I would expect to see as cooking changes and becomes a little bit different over time and in different places.
Yeah, just as the deli changed when people moved to the burbs, everything has to change eventually. I guess nothing stays the same. However, the traditions remain, and that's one of the things I liked about this book. Michael, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and speaking with me. I've been speaking with Michael C. Zussman. His last name is spelled Z-U-S-M-A-N. And he wrote this book with Nick Zukin. The title is The Artisan Jewish Deli at Home. So if you want to make yourself some kishka or some kashya and varnishes, this is the book to do it.
Ed, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. You've been listening to Author, Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.